We're talking about the late stages of the history of God's people, conquered by Alexander, and he dies. And at his death, his land is divided between three of his generals. And two of them are important. Well, really just one is. He rules in Syria, the family, and they're the Seleucids. And of this group, only one of them is important, and that is Antiochus Epiphanes. Because for the very first time ever, he begins to persecute God's people, not for their land, but for their religious beliefs. He felt the Greek culture was the epitome of sophistication, and he felt the Jewish culture was so crude. And so he ordered people to stop circumcising their children and to stop avoiding kosher food. And he would torture and kill people who did, who continued doing these things. This posed a real challenge to God's people. Because all of a sudden, their concepts of good and evil and the justice of God didn't play out anymore. I've told you, and please remember this when you read the Old Testament, that for almost all of the Old Testament, there is no belief in life after death. So how is the justice of God going to be worked out on earth? And the answer to that is presented in some of the wisdom books I'll talk about in just a short while. I want to talk about the prophets. Israel's prophecy had nothing to do with our idea of what a prophet is. We believe a prophet is somebody who can predict the future. Amazingly, after the way they were clobbered by Michigan and I forgot who else, Penn State broke back into the top 25 this week. Well, their chances of staying there are nearly zero. They're playing at home, but they're playing Ohio State, undefeated, the number one team in the nation, okay? That is not going to be a happy picture. Supposing, by our view, if I would go to a prophet who would tell me who was going to win the game and by what score. The prophets in Israel occasionally announced the future, but that was not their main mission. Their main mission was allowing God to speak directly through them. In the historic and other books of the Bible, the Psalms and everything, the wisdom books we'll talk about, God touches someone and inspires that person to communicate sometimes the very words that God himself says. With a prophet, God will touch the prophet. And the prophet is an instrument of God directly speaking. And often the prophets will use God as speaking to the people. Listen, my people, I have warned you. That was the main function of prophecy. Now it begins way back in the history of the people, and it was marked by ecstasy. The early prophets would just really go into ceremonies and everything else. But each of the prophets, as I explained in our introduction to the Old Testament and the Bible, had different experiences of God, and they spoke to different cultural needs, and therefore their messages are different. The very first prophet whose writings we have, we've referred to several times a few weeks ago on Sunday, the prophet Amos. He's the one who experienced a God who had an absolute needy love for the outcasts of society. I compared him to St. Luke, who had a very similar experience of God, of Jesus, in the New Testament. And so Amos would be at the door on Friday telling God's people they should be here. But worse, Amos would be out in the pews really frowning upon all the people who, when we have food drives, And we're going to start one real quickly for Thanksgiving. Probably start it, I'll announce it this coming Sunday. It's our small food drive to collect non-perishables that we can give out on Friday. People who didn't care enough to just bring something every week, one item. And as I tell people, if they were just kind enough to bring one can of something for each day of the week, we'd have a mountain of food up there by Thanksgiving Day. Now, Amos would have a God who loved that, and a God who would be very disappointed with people who ignored it. Hosea, of all of the prophets, had the most passionate experience of God. It's like his God has a passionate love for his people. He's a God of mercy. Hosea marries a prostitute who, after a while being his wife, goes back to prostitution. And he takes her back. And he compares this to the way God related to Israel. God picked the people who had been prostituting themselves to all sorts of foreign gods before God entered their world. And he started blessing them by wedding himself to them in the covenant. But once they got security in the promised land, they started chasing foreign idols. And Hosea uses his relationship to show the people that this is how God is looking at his people. One of his nicer descriptions of anything is the tenderness of a dad dandling, bouncing his kid on his knee, the way God will love his people. And then Isaiah experienced a God like John's. Holy, holy, holy. And a God, therefore, who couldn't support an evil nation. And evil, by his standards, had nothing to do with whether they worshipped in the covenant. Evil, by his standards, dealt with how they were taking care of the widows, the orphans, the aliens in their society. Jeremiah experienced a God who was dealing with individuals. Prior to this, they had a social justice because they thought in social terms. And if the king violated the law, the people would suffer. And given the thought of their time, there was nothing unfair about that. But Jeremiah brings it down to a personal level. And for most of his book, he saw the sins of the people as so grave, he sees them as unforgivable. And it's like this people can never, ever be redeemed. Finally, at the end, he comes around and he shows the people that there is still some hope. Some people, some scholars think that it's a follower of Ezekiel who did that. And then just one final prophet to mention. There are four major, well, really three major. I've mentioned those. Daniel is listed with the prophets, but he's not a prophet. That's an apocalyptic book. Second, Isaiah is a section of Isaiah. And in this, we have four songs of the suffering servant. I'll refer to those when we talk about Jesus. Nearly nowhere else in the Old Testament is there any support for a Messiah who suffers and dies. The Old Testament expected a Messiah who would seize the sword and conquer. And Jesus didn't fit that bill. So for the early church, those four songs of the suffering servant become an outline showing that even the God of the Old Testament approved the ministry and the death of Jesus. One or two final points. They're very important. There's constant tension in the Bible between the reality of the experience of God's blessing and the reality of the experience of problems. And how do you bring them together? Since God must win out, and yet the people are being constantly conquered, especially after that time it becomes most serious, when Aristotle completely conquered the nation, and then the problems just kept increasing. There's got to come a time when the justice of God is finally going to conquer evil. And that confidence flows from the experience of God. There'll be a time when all chaos ended. And they refer to that, and when you hear these terms, any of them, they have much more meaning than almost anyone in the pew will ever read into them. They're referred to as the day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh. At first, the threat was to all the enemies of the people. But from Amos and the other prophets' time, the eschaton becomes, and that's the term, eschaton means last, final, it becomes a term to describe also a time when God would punish anyone who was evil in his own people. So, why is God waiting? And there's only one possible explanation, and here's where apocalyptic comes in. This strange thing, we talked about it, if you were here, when we introduced the literary forms of the Old Testament. It's the strangest of all of them. It seems to be predicting the future, but it's describing the past, all except for the last event. And everything that's not important here, except for the confidence of victory, everything is set out in set periods. And things add up to the numbers in a year or the numbers in a week. We'll get to the New Testament in a moment. These are ideas that were still left over from last week. God is biding his time because he set history into set periods. Now, it's important they know that because it explains why evil is still existing. But it's equally important then to know that evil is not going to stay victorious. There is an absolute guarantee that God will intervene and he himself will strike the enemies. Now, at first they thought it would be a king from the line of David, and that's based on 2 Samuel 7 to 12. When you're Samuel speaking, Nathan here speaking to David, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, when you die, I'll set up your seed after you, who will come from your body. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish his throne forever. Now, there's a few people who, from another prophecy, thought it would be a prophet like Moses, not a king. And that's Deuteronomy 18, 15. Moses is speaking to Joshua before the people enter the promised land. He's talking to the whole people. The Lord, Yahweh, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You shall heed such a prophet. And some people thought, well, the best thing is to do is combine them both, and God would send both a prophet and a king. And of course, Christians knew that Jesus fulfilled it. This is much more important because it deals with the New Testament. It has two views regarding the last days, and they're going to surprise you. One felt the final age. God has completed everything he's ever going to do. Began with the birth and resurrection of Jesus. Certainly, at the resurrection. Matthew describes the resurrection in apocalyptic terms. Matthew 27:50, 52. and the graves were opened. And many bodies of the saints which slept arose, and they came out of the graves. After his resurrection, they went into the holy city, and he appeared to many. They called that realized eschatology. Of course, our experience of it is only partial, but Jesus has finished perfecting. And you can see John reflects this when Jesus is dying on the cross. John 19, 30. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." Now that word in Greek means it's completed, it's perfected. Everything is done. Like the flower, the full blooming flower is the perfection of the seed. So the final days are complete. Only our experience of it is incomplete. Some New Testament writers thought it was still going to come. That would really be Mark and Paul and Luke, I think. And they call that future eschatology. Or a lot of our Christian friends refer to the rapture. It's a strange idea based on one text in Revelation. Revelation 20-6, and they shall reign with him 1,000 years, and then, when they're done, Satan's going to rise up in one horrendous last gasp, and then he'll be completely conquered after 1,000-year reign. At the end of 1,000 years, he's released. This has never been a dominant idea in Catholic thought or in the thought of most other Christians. And it's called millenarism. Here's something that will interest you. The end of the world, which we picture to occur at the final days, especially anyone who's ever seen the horrendous picture that Michelangelo painted of the end of the world, where the sun and the moon are falling and Jesus tells that story. The only place it could fall is on the earth, seemingly. But it's impossible for that to be the understanding that Jewish people had. They couldn't picture life without a world. Because, to be you, remember, you're not a spirit. You're one, body, soul, spirit, three aspects of one person, that you can't separate the aspects. So you can't be you without your body. And where's your body going to be if there's no world? And so they thought, and correct translations will correct things this way, they thought that the end would be the end of an age, an end of history as we know it, and the beginning of life, to quote the fairy tales, where we live happily ever after. There'll be nothing ever that can threaten us. When's it going to occur? Who knows? All through my life, we've had people, I remember starting with Garner Ted Armstrong back in the 50s, announcing he was reading all these signs in the Mideast. And people have continued to read all these signs in the Mideast. And I've known people who predicted it for the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. How are they going to know? Listen to this. Mark 13:32. But about that day, that's that phrase, or hour, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. So if Jesus doesn't know, nobody knows. I want to tell you briefly about Hebrew poetry. It will help you understand the Psalms when you hear them or read them on a Sunday. Different from ours, it has three basic forms. It's based on thought. and stress more than anything else, stress patterns that occur in the Hebrew. But the main thing is the thought. In the first, the same thing is said in two forms. A is B, and then A2 is B2. Here's your example. And this will correct the usage that Matthew makes of this quote. Isaiah 43, a voice cries out. Now, Matthew says the voice is crying out in the wilderness. No, the parallel shows you that can't be. A voice cries out, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. In the wilderness, the way of the Lord. And the next verse, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Wilderness, desert, way of the Lord, highway for our God. That's how we come to know the correct meaning of some biblical words, like justice and judge. They're parallel with saving. And that's so important to know. The second pattern is, you stress the opposite in the second verse. Proverbs 27:12. The clever see danger and hide, but the simple, that's really like the fool, they just go right on, and they suffer from it. The opposite of what the clever do. And then the third is neither A nor B, but the thought develops itself. And that's in the psalm we all love, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, in verse 6. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for years to come. And finally, a whole section of biblical literature about which we've said nothing, the wisdom books. They're among the last parts of the Old Testament, and they're very important because, like Antiochus did, most Greeks thought the Jewish culture was very crude. This is a religion based on animal sacrifice. That's its main purpose. And the Greeks lived for wisdom. If you call it this, they had their gods. Most of them pushed their gods off as absolutely irrelevant to life. The real thing they really worshipped was philosophy. Systems of thinking that put things together. Well, the wisdom books are a very late part after the Greek influence starts affecting the Jewish religion, following the Jewish people being conquered by Alexander. From then on, it's all Greek culture affecting them. Well, they had to prove that theirs was not a crude religion, and the wisdom books do this. Because they show first that God creates the world with wisdom. There's a whole section on that. They show God's people questioning. The book of Job is the wisdom book. In the face of evil, God inspires somebody to ask, why is this happening? And that's the important thing. Remember I told you the introduction and the end? We're pretty much conclusion. It's a wisdom book. Now, here are some of the wisdom books. Proverbs, collections of wise sayings for life. Psalms, we know those. We hear sections almost every Sunday. Job, other essays written, wrestling with the mystery of evil. And Essays on the Vanity of Life. That's one of the neatest books of the Bible. Probably get it wrong. I think it's Ecclesiastes or Ecclesiasticus. Begins with the phrase almost. Vanity, meaning silly, stupid. Vanity of vanities, all life is vain. What's the sense in getting married and making a career for yourself? You're going to die and go down a Sheol like everybody else. Hey, lay back. Quit your job. Come get food on Friday. Be one of the few people, and there are some, unfortunately, who do use our system. But they're going to die, and they're going to go to Sheol also, this netherworld. The richest do, the poorest do, the smartest do, the least educated do, the nicest do. Wish Martha were here. I'd use her. Even, according to this view, Penn State graduates go there. So everything is vain. If a Penn State education can't keep you out of Sheol, why go? All right, so here's the summary of the 4+ classes we've had on the Old Testament. Please, don't get lost looking at the leaves or the trees and miss the beauty of the forest. That comes through in the whole biblical booklet or the whole section from Genesis through Chronicles. Take it as one. Don't get lost looking at words, chapters, and phrases the way so many of us preachers do. The scope of the Old Testament reveals the experience of a God who wants us. I hope you've had the wonder of being in the mountains and seeing a starry night. And the God who made that infinite universe couldn't have his universe complete without you. A God who intervenes in our lives to save us from our own stupidities. A God who never gives up on us. A God who warns us of the folly of misusing our freedom. A God who offers us loving guidance for peace. A God preparing through all of the booklets of the Old Testament that reveal part of his love and saving help, to reveal the greatest of these, Jesus. Now we'll start the new class. I like this darkness. Okay. You were born in the year zero. And I don't like, you know, that's 2,000 some years ago. I don't like to give away Rhonda's age, but okay. So she was born in the year zero. Jesus was born 4 years before us, before her, because there was an error in the dating system. Around her 30th birthday, Jesus began ministering, suffered, died. Around her 50th birthday, Paul wrote his first letter. 20 years after her 30th birthday. Mark wrote on her 70th birthday. Matthew and Luke wrote around her 85th birthday. And I know she holds her age well, but John wrote around her 95th birthday. Now watch this. If that were true, for 40 years, Martha would be a Christian who had no written gospel. For 55 years, the church celebrated Jesus, including Martha, with just Mark to enrich it. Well, from the after 55 years, the church celebrated Jesus with just Mark. And then 10 years later, the church did this for 65 years. The church did this without John's tremendous portrait of the holiness of God. Now here's the conclusions from this. This is important. It corrects, again, that view that everything we believe is in the Bible. The Bible did not produce, now we're going to make this the church. The church exists 20 years before the first part of the New Testament is written. It exists 40 years before Mark is written. It exists 65 years before John is written. It exists almost 100 years before, if scripture scholars are correct, 2 Peter, the last of the New Testament, is written. And yet through all this period of time, the church gospeled. Look at Acts 8. This is Luke. When they had testified and proclaimed, that's gospeling, the word of the Lord. Galatians 1:8. Even if an angel of the Lord should preach to you a gospel other than the one we preach to you, Paul. Galatians 1:11 says the same thing. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, the proclamation that the gospel I preached is not something man made up. So it isn't the church, the Bible that produces the church. It's the church that produces the Bible. And that's why individual interpretation can have difficulties. Individuals can think they're experiencing Jesus in a booklet, and they can be wrong. But since the living, now when I say the church, it's not the church. It's Jesus. Jesus gives the church his spirit. This is the church. Now, this becomes the church with the spirit. The church then, by offering the different experiences of Jesus, making him real to the writers of the New Testament, inspires them to share Jesus. So how did the church come about? Well, read carefully. Jesus dies Easter Sunday. Dies Easter Sunday. He dies Good Friday. Rises Easter Sunday. He's taken into glory sometime. Luke says 40 days later. John says on Easter Sunday. And he stops being visible in our midst. But he promised us he wouldn't abandon us. And so, 50 days after Easter, he sends his spirit, his life force, down upon the church gathered together. The church begins after Easter when the apostles, even before Pentecost now, the church begins after Easter when the apostles have different experiences of Jesus, each of them. The living Jesus. If you read carefully between the lines, when Jesus died, they not only abandoned him, they went back to Galilee and began fishing. And what brought them back to make the church? John gives the scene where Jesus appears to seven of them fishing. In any case, there's just no doubt about it. The central message of the New Testament is, he lives. We want Jesus to exist. They'd almost be stunned at our attitude. They knew he lives. That's why they were the church. This was an experience that was changing them, saving them, making them a community. And there was something about this experience that needed to be shared with others. To proclaim this to the world. He lives. Let him live in you. Some of you might be old enough to remember the very popular religious song by the Bill Gaither Trio, "Because He Lives, I Could Face Tomorrow." The real message of the church is no. Because He lives, I can face today. I can enjoy today. And every today. Now, this is going to amaze you. The strangest thing about the whole New Testament is it never tries to prove the resurrection. And that's because the early Christians are people who are Christian precisely because they experienced the Spirit of Jesus. Proving the resurrection would be like mine approving, trying to prove to you that you have a nose while you're touching it. Well, of course, dum-dum. It's here. Proving the resurrection would be almost like, Saint dum-dum. He's here. He's inside me. I know he lives. So it's not a conclusion to which any New Testament booklet comes. Next crucial thing, and never forget this, the New Testament is written for a faith people. It's not a convert book for the world. There's a few sections in Luke that could be adapted for arguing, but that isn't the purpose of Luke. The purpose of Luke is for the community, the church, to enrich its experience of Jesus, and through this to enrich its understanding of what that experience means for them. That's the point. The Gospels are booklets of joy. Of all the words in the whole Greek dictionary, the word they chose to describe Jesus and their experience of him was good news. There might still be one or two older Catholics here. If he was a lawgiver, that's not good news. If he's a judge, that's not good news. If he's a bookkeeper recording, "I saw what you did. I saw what you did." That's not good news. And he's nowhere presented as this is the essence of who he is. Who is he? He's a God who breaks into our world to make us, gives himself to us, to make us everything we can be, and allows ourselves to experience the fullness of his life, not just some. All of it becomes ours. And as we experience it, brings us together and wants us to go forth and witness to this to other people. So the gospel is a person. There's only one gospel, Jesus. As I told you, every Christian experienced them differently. Many, many impressions were partially valid and partially wrong. When I get up to preach on Sunday, I'm never sure if what I'm sharing with you is absolutely true. I believe I have been privileged to know that the love of Jesus is in me. My 35 years of sobriety is certainly a starting point for that. And from that, I know that I didn't earn it. So Jesus comes as a gift. And I had done so many things wrong. But he's a forgiving gift. A cleansing gift. And to keep that gift, I got to be part of a group. So he forms community. And our whole mission is, we continue to stay sober by sharing with others. And so there's something about his spirit that tells us to go out and knock on doors. Tell people about it. Okay? So, the four Gospels we have are guaranteed by Jesus for 2 points. They accurately experience who he is. Please remember, they cannot and do not experience everything that he is. He's too intimate for that. They could only have partial experiences of who he is. But Jesus guarantees them. And secondly, I get an idea in my head, and I share it. And people come up in the congregation, and they thank me for saying something I know I didn't say. Okay? That happens more than once. The four Gospels accurately convey what they want to say about Jesus. Just as the other books of the Bible, that doesn't guarantee all the facts they give. It guarantees the truth of the experience of Jesus, what this truth means in our lives as it touches us and forms us into a witnessing community. Okay? So here's what probably happened. After Jesus came, he preached, healed, and taught. And he gathered 12. He was arrested and crucified. I think even the most critical scholars agree that those are basically true facts. When he was arrested, as I shared, his disciples were discouraged. They went back to Galilee. And John reports this, how Jesus comes and dramatically gives them his mission on Easter Sunday. John 20:19, Jesus came, stood among them, and he said, "Peace." Now that means shalom. May every relationship you have be in perfect order with God, with yourself, and with everybody else. Peace. Now listen to this. As the Father has sent me, I send you. As means with, as well as according to. With the love that the Father gives me as his Son, that's how the Father is sending you. I'm giving you that love. And the way that love caused me to minister, as in that sense, is the way that love wants you to minister. And then the scene I love so well. After this, these great founders of a church, what do? Start knocking on doors? They go back to Galilee and go fishing. Now you understand what has just happened? Jesus has come and he's knocked on their door. Hey, I am giving you right now today, Don, my mission to save the world. And then you go out and you go hunting. Well, you're not saving the world. You might end up shooting some deer or some quail. Okay? They go fishing. John 21:3. Simon Peter, this great head of the church, "I'm going fishing." So they said, "We'll go with you." The return of the discouraged disciples explained the resurrection promise in Mark and Matthew. Don't be afraid, Matthew 28:5. "I know that you seek Jesus." 7. "Go quickly. Tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead, and indeed he's going before you into Galilee. There you will see him." And Galilee, where they had gone fishing, is almost certainly the historic spot where they really experienced Jesus. There can't be any doubt about it. There is some dramatic experience of Jesus. Despite this, every gospel gives a scene in which there are still doubters. That's how real these gospels are. Look at Luke. Easter Sunday. After he appears to the two disciples on their way to Emmaus. 24:37. He comes before all of them. They were startled and frightened, thinking they saw a ghost. And he said, "Why are you troubled? Why do doubts rise in your mind?" Or they doubt what they're experiencing. Matthew, the last scene of his gospel. They're all up on a mountaintop with Jesus, the 11 of them. Matthew 28:17. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubted. And yet Jesus gathers them back together as a community. How do they do this? When do they get his Spirit? There's different traditions. Luke says, as I told you, 50 days after Easter. Acts 2:1, when the day of Pentecost, Pente comes from the Greek word for 50. They're all gathered in one place. Suddenly from the heavens there came the sound like the rush of a violent wind. Wind, breath, spirit, all the same word. Divided tongues as of fire appeared among them and rested on each of them. John says it happened on Easter. John 20:22, they're hidden behind locked doors. Comes and he breathes on them, he's inspiriting them. Receive the Holy Spirit. Hey, when they experience Jesus isn't important. That they experience him is important. To understand the New Testament, we've got to see how different the early Christians were from what we are. We would expect the disciples immediately to start writing memories. Bush is still in office and people have left his administration. They've written books. They're making money. And the books are being sold. And we would expect a lot of additional accounts from other disciples. And the opposite is true. As I shared, for 20 years, there's not a single written document. There isn't a gospel for 50 years. The real problem with the New Testament, if you understand the culture in which it was written, is not why so little was written, but why anything was written. Their real assumption was they experienced Jesus and they lived him. And they, through this living, they touched the hearts of other people in the way they spoke. And they experienced Jesus. So that's all they were interested in. Helping people experience Jesus, become part of their community, and witness with them. Now that helps explain. So why did they write? Especially against the background of Jesus returning quickly. Would you write a history If you honestly expect Jesus would return before either this New Year's or next New Year's and end the world forever, that's a lot of wasted effort. Why go to that effort? There's no sense in that. The only reason they wrote, and this is very important, with only one exception as far as I know, the only reason they wrote documents in the New Testament was to handle problems. And the only exception is Paul's letter to the Romans. There are no real big problems in the Roman community of which Paul's familiar. He had never been to Rome, unlike many of the other churches he writes letters to. But he's planning to go there. And since he has this reputation of being an apostle to the pagans, and Rome is the center of pagan life, he wants to lay the foundation for his visit. So he writes that letter. But every other letter that in the New Testament and the Gospels answer a problem. The very first letter, if scripture scholars are correct, is 1 Thessalonians. And it deals with a problem that's going to occur and occur and occur. And the early Christians had experienced death. They knew Jesus would come back, and whoever was alive when he returned would never die. But did he, and this boggled the mind, did he have the power to take a body that has completely decomposed to dust and bring it back to life? That's impossible. That can't be. Yet Paul experiences a Jesus who can. And so, he says, in 1 Thessalonians 4:13, I don't want you to be ignorant, brothers, about those who have fallen asleep. 15. We say to you by the word of the Lord, that's big, that we who are alive will by no means precede those who are asleep. And then here's what they needed to know about their sisters, their brothers, their mothers, their children. The Lord himself will descend, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive shall remain and be caught up together with them in the clouds. Well, again, people dispute whether Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians. If he did, here's the problem. People don't change. If Kathy knew Jesus was returning within 14 months, she had any common sense like most Americans, she'd close up her store, turn all the money into vacation trips, and just go cruising until Jesus came, cruising into her life, and took her forever. So some people were just not working. And basically what Paul says in 2 Thessalonians is no work, no eat. 2 Thessalonians 3:10. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. And Galatians starts dealing with a very ticklish problem. The Greek converts weren't obeying the Jewish law. They weren't circumcising their kids, and they weren't following the kosher rules. And some, after Paul came and made pagans Christians, now, he didn't make them, Jesus did. But Paul's preaching opens their hearts because it was inspired preaching. And they experience Jesus. And he comes as a gift. No circumcision, no rules. And then people come up from Jerusalem and they try to force the law on people. And some in Galatia were believing this. Paul, this is an angry letter. It's the maddest letter Paul writes. One little section. I marvel that you are turning away so soon from Him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. There are some, verse 7, who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. Listen to what Paul says in verse 8. Even if we or an angel preach any other gospel, let him be accursed. That's a nice way of saying go to hell. First Corinthians deals with a whole slew of questions. They had chaotic worship. We talked about that earlier. They're allowing grave moral problems. Incest with a mother-in-law, a stepmother. And then big problems of belief. Some denying the resurrection. And what disturbs Paul as deeply as any of those others, they were losing their sense of community. They were forming cliques. Okay, so Paul writes the letter. I could go into the other documents. The only other ones about which I want to comment are the Gospels. And they were written starting around 40 years after Easter, 70 AD. One event leads eventually to Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And that's the destruction of the temple. Mark, writing the first, has to deal with the real problem. Okay, Jesus is the Messiah. Since He's the Messiah, why did He allow the city of God to be destroyed? Is this the start of the end of the age? Is the eschaton coming? Another term for that is the parousia. Mark's answer, no. And he uses a Markan sandwich. One scene with another in between, and they interpret each other to show why. On Monday of Holy Week, Jesus is leaving Bethany, and He's hungry. Mark 11:12. Seeing in the distance a fig leaf, He went to find fruit. Listen to this, because it sounds petty. When He reached it, He found only leaves, because it wasn't the season for figs. And then He said, in essence, He curses the tree. May no one ever eat fruit from you again. Then He enters the temple, and He performs three actions that, in essence, curse the temple. Mark 11:15. Jesus began driving out those who were buying and selling there, overturned the tables of the money changers, and 16, wouldn't allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple court. Now, each of these affects a violent aspect of temple life. Driving out the animals makes animal sacrifice impossible, because you needed a pure animal. And how do you know after bringing it from home or on a ship from Spain, the temple priests are going to pronounce it pure? So the animal sellers were providing the ability to continue sacrifice. Overturning the tables of those changing money would end the temple financially. Every Jewish person had a yearly tax to pay, and only one coin of the time could be used because every other one had the image of a pagan ruler on it, and that would be horrid to God, to use the picture of a pagan ruler. That's idolatry. So whatever their coins were at home, they had to change these into the coin of the day. And by driving out the money changers, therefore, Jesus is ending the finances of the temple. And then finally, he orders people not to carry anything around. Basically, that makes any worship activity at all in the temple area impossible. So, those three actions are cursing the temple as he had cursed the fig tree. On Tuesday, and this is the other part of the sandwich now, Mark 11:20, in the morning as they went along, they saw the fig tree that Jesus had cursed withered from the roots. And to show you I'm using the right word, 21, that was Mark 11:20, now 21, Peter remembered, and he said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has been withered." Okay, Jesus cursed the tree, and it looked alive, like nothing happened. He goes into the temple, curses the temple, and the next day everything's back to normal. Probably in about 20 minutes it was all back to normal. Like the tree looked alive, the temple looks alive. But the next day the tree is dead. It was dead in its roots when Jesus spoke, and it took the leaves a day to find out. When he curses the temple, it looks alive in its leaves, but it's dead in its roots. Now, all of this is told for this point. When the Romans come and destroy the temple, and they do, they completely level the temple of Herod, right before Mark writes, in about the year 70. That's when the Romans did this. They were just cutting down a dead tree. And so, nothing important to God was destroyed by the Romans. Now, Matthew also wrote in response to a chain of events, which began with the destruction of the temple. To get the background for this, up until the Romans destroyed the temple, the Jewish religion was then, as it is today, a very tolerant religion. I shared before, you can be a Jew welcomed into Israel for citizenship without believing in God at all. You just need to have Jewish blood. Well, at the time of Jesus, you had the Pharisees. They were people who were going the extra mile. They were sort of the monks of their day. They fasted much more than the Bible said. The Bible had one or two fasts a year. They fasted twice a week. They gave more than the Bible said. The Bible said 10% of certain things. They gave 10% of everything. And then you got the Sadducees. They were the fundamentalists. Basically, they only believe in the first five books of the Bible. And if it ain't there, it ain't part of the Jewish faith. Angels ain't there, and a whole host of other things. And so you don't believe in them, including heaven and hell. I mean, heaven at all. and hell, yeah. A group called the Essenes, if you wear crossword puzzles, they keep popping up. They felt that all life had become so corrupt, so unclean. The only way to stay clean was to go off and the Pharisees weren't the monks, the Essenes were. The Pharisees were more like the people. I guess I gave all the wrong comparisons. The Pharisees would be like real fundamentalist Christians who, if you got to go that extra mile, and you got to do it. And the law is the only important thing. It's more important than anything else. Don't break that law. Keep the Sabbath, even if you've got a sick kid at home. You go to the temple and you observe the Sabbath worship. The Essenes said all of his life is sick. And they went off and they lived in monasteries like the one at Qumran where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a group called the Zealots from Zeal. They couldn't believe that God would allow pagans to keep their country. And so they believed that God was going to raise up a Jewish army and with the sword utterly throw the Romans out forever from the Holy Land. Judas, in all probability, belonged to that group. Judas Iscariot. Iscariot means knife. And it's very likely he turned his back on Jesus because Jesus rejected the sword for the cross. And when Jesus in the garden told people to put away the sword, that really would have been the crowning blow. Earlier than that, he already had said he was going to go suffer and die. And so Judas would have nothing to do with them and betray them. The sooner you get rid of him, the sooner the real Messiah will appear. Grab that sword, and we're going to kick the butt of the Romans. Get them out of our land, as God wills. And the Herodians, well, they were just political brown-nosers. They compromised with the hated Herod and the Roman rulers. Okay? The scribes, you may want to almost keep those pages somewhere on file as you look at the Bible to go back and understand what the groups were. The scribes aren't a separate sect. They can be part of any of the groups. They were people who, by their leisure to write, were scholars of the law. Not political law, but the law of the Bible. And so they were the ones who really knew the ins and outs of the Old Testament law. Well, from, I don't know from when, probably for 200 years, the Jewish religion allowed all these people to be part of it. What held them together was the recognition of temple sacrifice. The Essenes did it on their own, but they recognized that sacrifice was important. And as long as this held the people together and that made them Jewish, you can believe whatever you want. But then, when the temple was destroyed, temple sacrifice ended. Now, what's going to show the world that you're Jewish? How are people going to know that you belong to the Jewish faith? It can't be temple sacrifice anymore. So what's it going to be? And at this point, the synagogues become important with the masters of the law, the scribes, and they become the rabbis, the experts, and they make the law the standard by which you can tell if somebody is Jewish. Especially the kosher law, the food, avoiding everything unclean, and only eating and doing things that are clean. And circumcision. And keeping the Sabbath, three things. Well, up until the temple was destroyed, Christians were seen as just another sect of the Jewish faith. And the early Christians saw themselves that way. They'd go to the temple first to worship, and then they'd come home for the breaking of the bread. And they almost certainly did that till the temple's destroyed. But now the temple's destroyed. And the Jewish people have to decide who they are. It took about 20 years, and the rabbis meet. And they finally decide that what's going to make you Jewish is keeping the law. By their very existence, the Christians violated that law because they admitted into their group, as a matter of fact, their group by this time, this is about 70 years after Jesus, about the year 100, their group is predominantly Jewish. I mean, nope, got that completely wrong. Their group is predominantly Greek. And so the Jewish people throw them out. And they even, this is debatable, but there's some evidence for this. There are daily prayers that every Jew says, blessings. Well, one of those blessings was a curse on the followers of the Christos, the anointed Christ. So basically, Christians who had their whole life had been going to the temple were excommunicated. They come to the temple one Sabbath to worship and the doors are shut on them. And the next thing they know, they're being cursed. How do you explain that? That's the problem that Matthew addresses in his gospel. Matthew's answer, the church is the new and true Israel. Jesus is the new and perfect Israel, Moses, and he hands his spirit over to the church, and that's what makes us the true Israel. The church continues to live his spirit. The church is being persecuted by the same Jewish leaders who persecuted Jesus. But Christians must be part of the real family of God. And the true family is God, is not based on blood the way the Jewish people saw it, but on doing the will of God. This theme is so important in Matthew, and therefore in Mark. Matthew 12:48. He's told that his mother and his brothers and sisters are outside asking for him. And he responds in 48. Who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched out his hand toward his disciples and he said, here are my mother, my brothers, and my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, and doing the will of God doesn't mean obeying the law. It means accepting Jesus as the one God sends to save us. Letting him save us. Love us and serve us. Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother, mother, and sister. So kinship in the New Testament isn't based on a relationship with Abraham, physical blood, as was membership in the first Israel, and according to the Jewish faith, still is, unless a goyim, a pagan, converts and is circumcised. But they'd be just the very smallest group of people. Sammy Davis. He converted to the Jewish faith as an adult. You become part of the new people of God by having faith in, not about, Jesus. The old Israel rejects Jesus and kills its Christ. And that makes them cease to be God's people and paves the way for the new one. And that scene occurs in the Passion. Matthew 27:21. Jesus is before Pilate. What shall I do with Jesus called the Christ? They all answered, crucify him. When Pilate saw he was getting nowhere, but an uproar was started, he took water, washed his hands. I'm innocent of this man's blood. It's your responsibility. And here's the phrase that causes them to cease to be the true Israel. Let his blood, that means his life, be on us and on our children. For his love and his life truly are on them and on their children forever, but in a different way. Israel continued to claim an automatic relationship with Jesus. The church has the blood relationship. So, what difference does it make when Jerusalem was destroyed? It's no longer the house of God. The church now is. And I hope we can get through Luke tonight. Luke writes two books. They're united by a geographic theme. Look up a moment. The first one starts in Jerusalem. That's where Zechariah is when the angel comes and announces the birth of John the Baptist. And then it kind of goes up. And the rest of the gospel has Jesus heading to Jerusalem, including in a very big way, a 9-chapter journey. Then in Jerusalem, he reaches the city, and he suffers and he dies. And he resurrects in Luke. He stays there. And the church stays there, and that's the start of Luke's second book. Remember, accidentally separated by some later person who can put all the booklets together in the first Bible, primitive version, collection. But originally, the gospel and the second book, the book of Acts, were meant to be read together. And the gospel, the book of Acts, starts in Jerusalem. The church is gathered. The Spirit comes down on Pentecost. We read some of those texts. Filled with the Spirit, they go out and they start ministering. And you see the spread of the church until the book of Acts ends with Paul preaching in Rome, the center of the known universe of his time. And all of this is tied together by references to the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Jesus gets it not when he's baptized, as happens in Mark and Matthew, but when he is praying after baptized. Look on the top of page 24, Luke 3:21. When all the people were baptized, now the English doesn't do it right. Luke makes the baptism absolutely unimportant. Jesus also having been baptized. As he was, and this is the verb form that says you stay doing it. As he remained in the act of praying, the heavens opened and the Spirit descended. And what happens in Acts? The church remains in a state of prayer in Jerusalem. Acts 2:1. When the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Then there appeared to them divided tongues of fire, and one set upon each of them. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit, and they began to speak with other tongues, as the Spirit gave them utterance. So, this is God's Spirit. The place where God is dwelling is not a building. The place where God is dwelling is a people. His spirit left the temple when the curtain is torn and Jesus dies. And so the building has lost its place and comes down upon the church. And the church then becomes the new Israel. I might be able to finish John. Yeah. John has an entirely different problem. Almost all scholars agree it's the last of our four Gospels. And John's community was blessed to include somebody who had actually walked with Jesus. Supposing Jill had been present at the ministry of Jesus pretty much from the start on. She watched him minister. She watched him heal. Watched him forgive. Watched him feed the crowd. Watched him unite pagan and Jew. Watched him give his life to everybody. Experienced him resurrecting. And then felt the wonder of his spirit. John has it on Easter Sunday. Filled with the spirit of Jesus himself, his life force. Now, that's going to be important. In John, the dude who experienced all this, the Jew of his generation, is referred to as the beloved disciple. He was someone who knew Jesus. Modern scripture scholars are positive it was not John the disciple, the apostle. It's just a follower. It is a disciple, but not one of the 12. And this little community, and all the Christian communities were isolated geographically. This little community would have problems come up. New circumstances, squabble between people. And they'd go to Jill and say, Jill, you knew Jesus. How would he handle this? And Jill would go back in her memory, which was better than mine, come up with a scene and apply it. And the church had its living answer. Then all of a sudden it can't be Jill anymore because the beloved disciple died. Now they're lost. What are they going to do? Let's show you this. He's the only disciple who remains loyal at the cross. John 19:26. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved, he's the first one to believe in the resurrection. Early on the first day of the week, Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running. The other disciple outran Peter, reached the tomb first. He waits for Peter. Finally, who goes in and doesn't understand. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first went in. He saw and believed. He's the first disciple who believes. And his last living witness is death. What are they going to do? They were lost because they were in very different circumstances now. A completely new world than the 12 had faced when they started out from Jerusalem. They were in a basically Roman world, a Greek culture. I'm sure several thousand or over 1,000 miles from Rome. I'm guessing 300, 400, or 500 from the Holy Land. How are they going to resolve new questions? Aha! The answer occurs in a great priestly prayer Jesus gives at the Last Supper. This is only in John. It's 4 chapters long. And Jesus sends the paraclete, The Greek word parakletos can mean spirit, advocate, or God. John 14:15, I'll pray the Father, and He will give you another helper, the Spirit of Truth. 14:25, but the helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, He will teach you all things. John 15:26, when the Helper comes, who I'll send to you from the Father, the Spirit of Truth, He'll testify to me, and you will bear witness. John 16:7. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth. It's to your advantage that I go. For if I don't go, the Helper won't come to you. But if I depart, I will send Him to you. And when He comes, He will convict the world. Okay? So now how are they going to find their answer? In the Spirit that Jesus gives. The Spirit of Jesus alive in the church will do what the last living disciple did. And they won't have to worry about that anymore. So Matthew, Mark, Luke handle problems flowing from the destruction of the temple, and John, a problem flowing from the death of the last witness. All problem literature.